superconductors. If it's zero, we don't have a superconductor. If it's nothing. And then you do the diagram of the spectrum, and it kind of look like a parabola, and you showed like the parent gap was like between. I'm just wondering, like, I'm not really sure, like, to see, like, when there is a gap that I'll get a superconductor. Like, I don't understand how to interpret this graph. So I was wondering, like, is there something you can see from here saying, okay, we have this gap and it's superconductor versus if it touches the axis, we don't have one.
No, the statement is to see superconductivity, it's better if you go through the Ginsberg-Landau route. So that there you see the Meissner effect, for example, from the response. To directly see that without going through that route, you can still argue about superconductivity using the type of Landau type of argument I outlined yesterday, right? So think of it as a superfluid. Right? It flows, and then if there is a gap to the excitation, then the flow doesn't dissipate.
Okay.
Basically, because you have a gap, right?
Okay. Right. So just from like the spectrum itself, there's nothing that's telling us whether or not.
Yeah. Just from the spectrum itself, it looks like a semiconductor.
Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah. In fact, that's what I'm going to talk about today. Just look at the spectrum. It looks like an insulator. And yeah. All right. So actually, before begin the main thing today, let me just comment about what do we learn out of BCS, really. Okay. So what is a superconductor? There are four levels of information. So the first one is a superconductor means that there exists a charged condensate or a charged operator, if you like, that gains a non-zero expectation value. Okay. So for U1, under the U1 charge conservation symmetry, phi goes to e to the I, let's say q theta times phi, right? Where q is the charge carried by this operator. So charge q. The second thing we learn is in usual BCS superconductor, and in fact in all the superconductors discovered in the lab, Q equal to 2. That's the minimum possibility. Of course, you can always fantasize about extremely exotic superconductors where Q equal to 2 is not condensed while Q equal to 4 is condensed. There's nothing wrong with that in theory. Just people haven't found it yet. Right, so this is, of course, in which case phi is roughly C dagger C or CC. There might be some spin index and momentum index, and we call it Cooper pair. The third thing we learn is that the reason you have that Cooper pair condensate is because there is a weak coupling instability. Of the Fermi surface or the Fermi liquid. So the charge condensate comes from a weak coupling instability of a Fermi liquid. Right, so as I showed you, if I have an attractive interaction near the Fermi surface, even an infinitesimal one will lead to such an instability. And the fourth statement is that this weak coupling that leads to the pairing instability comes from electron phonon, is induced by electron phonon interaction. So that's the full content of the BCS theory of superconductivity. And the order I listed is such that the upper ones can be true while the lower ones doesn't necessarily have to hold. So essentially, when people talk about unconventional superconductor, what they mean is that one of this is not true. So this one has to be true because it's basically nowadays the working definition of superconductivity. Yes?
I have a question. What is Q?
Q is the charge. Yeah. For example, for Cooper pair, Q is 2. Right. It's the object, the charge of the object that that condensed.
Why the first one cannot be the definition for the normal conductor?
Now, the thing is, if you have a charged object that goes to a condensate, basically you get the Meissner effect. Right. So this is always true by definition. And this one is true for all real materials so far, right? There's no reason that there can't be a material that does this. So, which means mostly three and four may not be true for some real superconductors. And we call them unconventional. For example, helium-3. Okay, it's technically a superfluid, it's not a superconductor. But still, we know that it doesn't come from electron-phonon interaction. So one hallmark of electron-phonon interaction, one necessary consequence of electron-phonon-induced superconductivity is that it's always S-wave. Essentially, the pairing, or if you like, the excitation, the pairing is a function of momentum, which is like ck, c minus k, is independent of the direction. That's what we call an S wave, because it has angular momentum zero. And this is essentially because the interaction, the attractive interaction induced by electron phonon coupling is homogeneous, isotropic, sorry. It doesn't depend on the direction. And therefore, the induced gap also doesn't depend on the direction. And this is manifestly not true, for example, in helium-3. So there it's a P wave pairing. So it can't possibly come from electron phonon. In fact, it comes from magnetic fluctuation. So 4 is not true, 3 seems to be true, more or less. And there's the object called high TC. Well, nowadays when people say high TC superconductor, it actually means multiple things. But let me specifically focus, talk about the most mysterious one. It's the high TC cuprate, copper oxide, plus others. Bunch of other stuff. So this has been the most mysterious material since the 80s. So there, 4 is definitely not true. Because again, it's not an S wave, it's a D wave. I think that might even be your homework. So it doesn't come from electron phonon. And 3 is most likely not true. Which means it doesn't come from a weak coupling. Most likely, it doesn't come from a weak coupling instability of the Fermi surface. Okay? You need some strong coupling mechanism. Okay? And as a matter of fact, in cuprate, the interaction strength is of the same order as the Fermi energy.
What do you mean by like most likely not true? Like
people still argue.
Okay.
But most likely, it's not true. Now the thing is one has to be a little bit careful what one means by strong coupling, because a Fermi liquid microscopically can be quite strongly coupled, which is true actually for helium-3. But the Fermi liquid at the end of the day looks like a, you know, weakly coupled description. Right? So that, if you classify that as weakly coupled, then for example, helium-3 looks like weakly coupled stability, while cuprate still most likely is not. Right, so this is just a flavor of, for example, for the cuprate at the region called optimum doping, it's the most famous non-Fermi liquid ever been found experimentally. So even the basic premise of this statement is not true. So for today and Thursday, let me talk about probably the simplest kind of unconventional superconductor, nothing even close to cuprate. And still, you can think of it as weakly coupled, which is known as, why did I erase that? Which is known as topological superconductor. So if you like, you can still write down models for which they come from weak coupling instability. But not electron phonon induced, at least not electron phonon alone. It can be electron phonon combined with some other stuff. Okay, so a simple class. It's called topological . So for that, let's revisit what we have for a superconductor at low energy. Let me ask the question, what are the excitations? Typically, I mean, unless you have some special situation, otherwise, at low energy, you have a bunch of gap excitations. They are your Bogoliubov fermions. So in principle, depending on your actual situation, for example, if I'm dealing with superfluid helium-3, there's a Goldstone mode. Even for real superconductor, there's the phase mode, which is gapped by the photon. And in principle, they are still legitimate stuff to consider. But let me consider a situation where mean field theory works pretty well. So let's ignore fluctuation in delta. And then, okay, as you asked before, if I only look at the spectrum, it almost looks like just like an ordinary insulator, right? So it'd be, ironically, a superconductor actually behaves more like an insulator than a conductor. Because it's gapped, right? For a conductor, for a metal, near the Fermi surface, you have infinitely many very low energy excitations. Well, that's not true for a superconductor. And that statement actually has real consequence. So this statement actually has content. For example, if you measure thermal conductivity, in a metal, you get very good thermal conductivity. I mean, just think about your, I don't know, spoon. While a superconductor doesn't really conduct heat if you go to low enough temperature. It's a perfect conductor of electricity, but it doesn't conduct heat, right? Essentially, the Grad theta mode that's responsible for Meissner effect doesn't transport entropy. Okay. So it's an insulator. The only difference between this and the ordinary insulator, let's say a usual semiconductor, is that there's no U1 symmetry. But without charge conservation. Or U1 symmetry. Otherwise, it's just an insulator. And then when we have an insulator, we can play the same game I played 2 weeks ago and ask, could this insulator be somehow topologically non-trivial? And the answer is, of course, yes. So we can have superconducting analogs of chain insulators and integer quantum Hall effect. So this is related to the question, to the one point I made before. So if I take an ordinary BCS type, like S wave, the simplest kind, I told you, I didn't show you, it's actually non-trivial to actually show, but it's true that the BCS superconductor is adiabatically connected to the BEC limit, where you have tightly bound Cooper pairs that forms a simple Bose-Einstein condensate. So this picture is very similar to what I said about insulators, right? Some insulator, let's say take your 1D type binding model, make it half filled, and then open up a charge density wave. Kind of gap, very often it can be deformed to an atomic limit in which you get, for example, precisely one particle per side or something like that, not moving. So these two pictures look very similar. In fact, this BEC is the superconducting analog of atomic insulator. And then, in the case of insulator, we've seen examples of insulators that cannot be deformed into such atomic limit. The example we went through is the chain insulator, but there are other examples depending on symmetries and dimensions. And it turns out that's also true for superconductors. So not all superconductors can be adiabatically deformed into this boring, into this simple limit. Yes?
I have a question. What do you mean when you say without charge conservation?
Yeah, take the mean field, let's say fixed delta. Forget about the fluctuation in delta. Right? Then the Hamiltonian looks like some kinetic term, right? Plus this delta times c dagger plus delta star cc. Right? So this Hamiltonian has no charge conservation symmetry. Right? So this term creates charge by 2. It breaks charge conservation. So that's the thing we're going to look at today and Thursday. So we'll see some of the cool consequences of we'll see some examples of such topological superconductivity and see some of the cool consequences. Okay? So for today we look at a 1D example. So take a 1D superconducting wire. Some of you, for those of you who are overeducated and object immediately by saying one, there's no superconductor in 1D, well, put it on the top of a 3D bulk, then it's okay. Anyway, so this example is also known as key type chain. Or you can say it's spinless superconductor with a p-wave pairing. So the Hamiltonian in mean field, let me write it in real space. So far I've been writing out mean field Hamiltonian exclusively in momentum space, but there's no reason why you can't write it in real space. Just so think about a tight binding. So you say, now think about a tight binding model. Right, so on every, let me call this site I, on every site I, there's a ci, just like your old examples, except now this is a superconductor. So how do I represent that? Well, the Hamiltonian is, there's your good old friend Hopping term, ci dagger ci plus 1 plus ci plus 1 dagger ci. So that's the normal Hopping term. If you like, you can add the usual chemical potential term. Now let me add another term, which is delta times summing over I, Ci, Ci plus 1 without the dagger, plus its Hermitian conjugate, which is Ci plus 1 dagger, Ci. So let me put delta to be real. Yes?
Sorry, we have a question going back to the charge conservation.
Yes.
Why don't we have charge conservation? Because we have one term that creates two and one term that annihilates two.
Yeah, you don't multiply these two together, they add. Right? So for example, you start from a state with charge Q, you act with that Hamiltonian. What do you get? You get a superposition of charge Q plus 2 and charge Q minus 2. So a charge eigenstate becomes a charge non-eigenstate. So that's so if it's a if you do have charge conservation symmetry, or if U1 is a symmetry with your Hamiltonian, which means U1 commutes, the charge commutes with your Hamiltonian, then you act with the Hamiltonian on a state with charge Q, it should get back to you another state with charge Q. So that's the content of charge conservation. So that's manifestly violated by the mean field Hamiltonian.
Are you using a dagger here?
Oh, sorry, yes. So let's ignore, as I said, let's ignore the fluctuation in delta. Delta, in principle, in reality, is a fluctuating order parameter, but let's ignore that. So as I said, in 1D, technically, you shouldn't do that. It turns out you shouldn't ignore the fluctuation, and turns out the fluctuation will destroy everything, or most of the stuff I will be saying. But if you like, you can imagine this wire is on the surface of a three-dimensional bulk superconductor. And then the fluctuation will be living in the whole 3D system, for which ignoring the fluctuation will be justified. In fact, that's how people actually do it. Okay. So now, so this is called P wave because if I look at this term, Ci, Ci plus 1 is odd under the exchange, under inversion. If I invert I to minus I, it goes like, so essentially I exchanges I plus 1 and I, I get a minus sign because of the Fermion anti-commutation. So you should think of the pairing as an odd function, as odd under inversion. So that's why it's called P wave. Because that's what an angular momentum one object does. So this type of Hamiltonian, this mean field, so now when I write it, this is a quadratic theory, right? It's a slightly weird because it has CC in it, which we haven't done before. But still, it's a quadratic Hamiltonian. It conserves lattice translation symmetry. So some form of Bloch theorem will still apply. It's a slightly weirder form, but still. So this type of mean field, so which means it's solvable. So this type of mean field Hamiltonian is also known as Bogoliubov-Degen. Actually, anyone speaks French? How do I pronounce this properly?
Degen.
Sorry?
Degen.
Degen? Okay, all right, well, BDG. As I said, you can do a Fourier, conserves lattice translation symmetry, so which means you can still try to solve it with a Fourier transform. It's guaranteed to make your Hamiltonian simple. So now we go do a Fourier transform and go to momentum space. In fact, this Hamiltonian at some special point turns out to be solvable even in real space. We'll do that later. But first, let's look at the momentum space picture. So what do I get? Well, remember CK, or you can write down CI as summation over K e to the I KI. I mean, when I write this I hat, I mean, just trying to not confuse you with the imaginary unit I. CK. And likewise for C dagger. So now you just substitute this and the version for C dagger into this. The sum over I will guarantee that the momentum will be opposite between these operators. You get, after some algebra, something like this. So before, in the usual type binding model, your sum over k in the Brillouin zone, which means from, let's say, minus pi to pi. But let me do a summation from 0 to pi. I mean, there's larger or equal, it doesn't really matter. And write it this way. Sorry. So this should be familiar from BCS, because remember, if I look at this matrix, this is essentially the Xk minus Xk in the Bogoliubov Hamiltonian. Actually, let me put. And the off-diagonal term are essentially the analog of deltas. The only difference here is now this delta comes with a factor sine k, which is why it's p wave, because sine k inverts sine if I go from k to minus k. The reason I'm not summing over the entire Brillouin zone, but only half of it, picking k from 0 to pi, is because in this formalism, I've already included fermion modes at momentum k and momentum minus k already. Right? So summing over half of the Brillouin zone in this formalism is already summing over everything.
So summing over the other half would just introduce a factor over half?
Basically, yes. And sometimes that's convenient as a trick, but in principle, these are all your physical degree of freedom. So now you can solve this Hamiltonian. This should look familiar to you by now. Again, it's a 2x2 Hamiltonian with this form. You can diagonalize it. And if you look at the spectrum, it looks like the eigenvalue will be plus minus ek, where ek is defined by 2t cosine k plus mu square plus 2 delta sine k square. Essentially c square plus delta square. And h in some, if I properly diagonalize it, let me call the diagonalized, the eigenvectors are gamma k plus and gamma k minus. Right, so they look like ek minus ek gamma k plus. Minus. So this will be a quite general pattern, that we'll be seeing more of these examples like this on Thursday. So if I plot it, what does it look like? Well, first of all, I have only half of my Brillouin zone. So it looks like from 0 to pi, I have something like this and something like this. So this is what it looks like. But of course, for ground state, I should make all this filled, all the states filled, and make all the states empty. So if I ask what are the excitations, it should be the particles here or holes here. Right, so excitations always come with positive energy. So if I focus on excitations, so it's more convenient if I do a particle hole transform on this and focus on the holes corresponding to this state. Which means let me define an object, gamma k, which equals to gamma k. Now this k runs in the entire Brillouin zone. But it equals to gamma k plus if k is larger than 0. But gamma dagger minus k minus, remember, if k is smaller than 0, larger than minus pi. Okay. If k is smaller than 0, then this minus k lives in between 0 and pi. So it's one of the things defined here. Okay. So once I do that, essentially, the Hamiltonian now looks like this, which is the familiar Bogoliubov Hamiltonian I showed you last week from BCS theory. Now this k runs from pi to minus pi. So what happens with the dispersion is that there's only a positive energy band that looks like this. Essentially, I've taken this part, flipped it, and then inverted in momentum. Okay, so enjoy it. And then there is, let me draw it with dashed line, this mirror band, which is unphysical, right? So there's only this positive energy band. But I can think of this half band as the particle hole conjugate of this band. I can think of this band as the particle hole conjugate of this. So it's a redundant description. So only this is physical. And this is redundant. But sometimes it's convenient to include both. It makes the math more straightforward. But anyway, so if I look at this energy and ask, is it gapped or gapless? Right, you see that generically it's gapped, right? It's gapless, meaning the E goes to 0 at some k, only if at some k both are 0. Right. So this is 0 only at k equal to 0 or pi. Right. So at 0 or pi, this is equal to some plus minus 2t, which means this Ek is gapped like this. If mu is not equal to plus minus 2t. So if mu is equal to plus minus 2t, then at either k equal to 0 or k equal to pi, the energy vanishes. So instead of getting something like this, you get something like this. Sorry. This is, for example, if mu is minus 2t. So then that means to go from mu smaller than 2t to mu larger than 2t, the gap will close. Right. Yes?
I missed what you said.
Yeah.
So we started with the one on the far left. We had the whole, we had the minus k and the plus k, and those gave us the two different bands.
Yeah, so k plus is this band, while k minus is this band.
Okay, and then to get to this one.
So I take this k minus, which has negative energy.
Yeah.
And I redefine a fermion, which is its dagger.
Okay.
So once it's dagger, that, you know, it becomes something like gamma dagger here. And if I want to convert that back to gamma dagger gamma, I have to switch the two operators, which will invert the sign of this. That creates another constant coming from the standard commutation, but I don't care about constant. So let's forget about constant.
Okay.
And then you get just EK EK here. So you get this.
And so, and what happened with this, so this physical one is the one what happens when you flip it over, and then
yes.
What's the redundant one?
Yeah, the redundant one is, for example, you can still choose to keep the modes here, right? just as a bookkeeping, if you like. Right? Yep. They don't really exist. So the part, you know, the modes, the hole here really means the particle here.
Okay.
So it doesn't represent any new mode.
Okay.
Right, so it's already there.
Okay.
And this redundancy sometimes is called particle host symmetry in the literature, which is very confusing because it's not a symmetry, it's a redundancy.
Okay.
Because now the thing is, once you draw it this way, I mean, these things are defined as the particle hole conjugate of the physical mode. So they are guaranteed to be particle host symmetric, of course. So, right, so for both mu less than 2t and mu larger than 2t, actually, let me just say, systems are gapped. But to go from one to the other, you go through the mu equal to 2t point, which is gapless. You can ask the question, is that necessary? Or the other way to phrase this is are they topologically distinct? Just like the difference between integer quantum Hall state or the chain insulator with a trivial atomic insulator. Of course, the answer is yes, otherwise I wouldn't bother. There are a couple ways to see why they are different. But the most illuminating way is to go back to the real space and solve it in real space. Do it here. So let's solve it in real space. It's really illuminating. And it turns out to be actually quite simple. It's simple if you choose the right basis. So let's choose a basis. Let's introduce a convenient basis. Which is, let me call the gamma. Okay. I used gamma there. It's probably not good to use gamma. So let's call it eta. So eta at site I. So now I'm in real space, right? The eta IA, let me call it CI plus CI dagger. And eta IB, let me call it CI minus CI dagger over I. I assume you won't confuse this I with, this is imaginary unit. Which of course means CI is what, eta IA plus eta IB over 2 CI, sorry, there's a I. CI dagger is eta IA minus I eta IB over 2. So it's just a basis change. Go from the C dagger basis to this eta A eta B basis. What's nice about this is that, first of all, the etas are Hermitian. Either A or B, if I take the dagger, explicitly you can see that it goes back to itself. So it's Hermitian. Unlike the CC daggers. The other thing is the inherent sum of the empty commutation relations. For example, if I take eta I prime not equal to I, whether it's A or B, it doesn't really matter. They anti-commute. Just this follows trivially from the CC dagger. Now if I look at the same site, you can check that eta I A, eta I B, this anti-commutation is also zero. Let me just check it for you. It goes as 1 over I CI minus CI dagger, because if you substitute this in, the CC anti-commutation is trivial. C dagger is trivial. So the only possible non-trivial contribution comes from the CI CI dagger. So it has this term and CI dagger CI. So, it's zero. Well, not everything is zero. For example, if I take the square of either A or eta A or eta B, you just square this operator, or this one. What do you get? So if I start square, let me just do the A for you. The B will follow the same logic. So it's C plus C dagger. Let me suppress the I index. It's obvious here. So CC and C dagger goes to zero, but then you get a CC dagger plus C dagger C, which is one. And it turns out that's also true for B. So which means for both A and B, they square to one. So the simple way to summarize all this commutation is to say, eta capital I, eta capital J is delta I, 2 delta ij. I means the collect index of I and A or B. So the important relation is the hermicity and this anti-commutation relation. And these two together defines what it means to be a Majorana fermion. Sometimes it's also called the real fermion. It's real because it's Hermitian, basically. Okay. But it's really just a basis change. But it turns out to be an incredibly nice basis change for this problem. Because now you can just substitute this basic change into the BDG Hamiltonian written here. Right. Just literally substitute those C's by CC daggers by eta. So that's straightforward. Let me just write down the answer for you. P over 2 I gamma I A gamma I plus 1 B, minus gamma I b gamma, sorry, eta. Yeah, I had gamma on my notes. I plus 1 a. Plus I delta over 2, sum over I, gamma I b, gamma I plus 1 a, plus gamma I a, gamma I plus 1 b. Sorry. This is what happens when you suddenly decide to change notation halfway. Minus I mu over 2, sum over I, eta I A, eta I B. Okay. So one pattern you realize is that the coefficient is always imaginary, and that's guaranteed by hermiticity, because there's I, gamma J. If I take the Hermitian conjugate of that is minus I, gamma J, gamma I. And when J is not equal to I, this is equal to I, gamma J. Right, so this factor of I is required to keep the Hamiltonian Hermitian. Right, okay, so the Hamiltonian looks like this. But now let's do something ingenious, which is to consider a special point. Which is when delta equal to t. So this is not necessary, but simplifies the problem drastically without losing the essential feature or creating some artificial, some too artificial feature. Not necessary, but simplifies. So why is that good? Because if delta equal to t, you realize that this is something like ib, I plus 1a. There's an ib, I plus 1a. These two come with opposite sign. So they cancel. Likewise, if you set delta equal to minus t, these two add up, but then these two will cancel. So one of these will cancel. Right, so you get a very simple Hamiltonian. What you end up getting is h equal to it, because now delta equal to t. Sum over I, b, gamma I plus 1a, minus I mu over 2, eta I a, eta I b. Okay. Now let's look at two limits. As I said, I want to understand the physics at mu smaller than 2t versus physics at mu larger than 2t. So let's look at it. So let's consider the first limit, which is mu much larger than 2t, for example. And in fact, let's just take t to be 0. It's even simpler. So at t equal to 0, you just get this term. And because different i's don't talk to each other, so it's essentially a bunch of decoupled or commuting terms. To solve the ground state, you just make each term happy. So in this case, the ground state, let's say all these are positive. Doesn't hurt. If they're negative, you get some signs. Then the ground state correspond to I, eta I A, eta I B, to be as large as possible for every site. So this is a Hermitian operator. And also, this operator squares to 1. Right? You can do a real check. This is something like minus, because of the I, eta A, eta B, eta A, eta B. Now you do an anti-commuting. So there is a eta A, eta B, but that gives you a minus sign, so this cancels. This is 1, this is 1, so this is 1. So this is a Hermitian operator that squished 1. So the eigenvalue can only be plus or minus 1. Which means if I want this number to be as large as possible, I put it to be 1. Okay. And in fact, this number is nothing mysterious. If you plug in the expression of eta in terms of C and C dagger, what you see is that, let me make sure my signs are correct. You see 2 CI dagger CI minus 1. Which means it's 1 if this fermion is occupied. The CI dagger CI is 1. And it's minus 1 if it's not occupied. So sometimes convenient to write it as minus 1 to the CI dagger CI. It's the same thing. And it's the same thing because this number can only be 0 or 1. Okay. So this expression is sometimes called the fermion parity. So this is just saying if mu is very large and positive, I want to keep this number to be 1. But this number being 1 means that CI dagger CI is 1, which just means I have all the atomic sites occupied by an electron, which is what you expect if I have a very large positive chemical potential. I want as many particles as possible, which means this is really an atomic limit. Defined by just filling 1 particle per site. But let me draw it a little bit differently. Like atomic limit, we can draw it essentially that way. But let me draw it in terms of the etas. Yes?
Can you just repeat a bit like what you were saying about this graph state, wanting it to be 1? Because now this other expression you wrote after is not, it's 1 if the CI dagger CI is 1, right?
Yeah. So you want CI dagger CI to be 1 on every side.
Oh, okay, so that's
yeah. CI. Yeah, yeah. You minimize this term, right? If mu is positive, you want this minus I eta eta to be as small as possible. So you want I eta eta to be plus 1. Yeah. This is the atomic limit, but let me now represent things in terms of the etas. So at every site I have this eta A, eta B. The next site, I plus 1, I have eta A, eta B, right? Blah, blah, blah. So this expression means that on every site, this I eta A eta B equal to 1. So let me represent it this way. So this circle means essentially whenever I have a circle like this with 2 etas, let me call this eta 1, eta 2. This represents a state where I eta 1, eta 2 is 1. It really means the fermions that occupies this site is filled. So that's the atomic limit. So now let's look at the opposite limit. Now let's look at the limit where mu is much smaller than t. In fact, just to make things simple, let's say mu is 0. T is non-zero. Let's say t is positive. What do I get? Actually, let me, just to make things convenient, let me take t negative. It's just slightly more convenient to write down things. You get less signs. It doesn't really matter, actually. So, yes. So if t is negative, then the only thing I'm left with is that eta ib eta I plus 1 a term. Yes?
So let me just ask, could you explain me what you meant by atomic limit again?
Yeah, so this, if I go back to the C dagger basis, this state is just saying on every site, I have my fermions occupied. Right, so if you write down the many body wave function, it's literally CI dagger multiplied by all I acting on the vacuum. which is almost, it's like the simplest atomic insulator. So this is as atomic as the atomic insulator you see. But you have a better idea what I mean after I talk about this opposite limit. So if I look at this one, so mu is zero, so there's only the first term that's there. And if you stare at that term, you realize that it's also, every term is also decoupled. Because it's only, let's say, site one with index b couples to site two with index a, but then site b at index two, the index b at site two only couples to index a at site three, and so on. So they are still decoupled, which means the ground state now has I eta I b eta I plus 1 a equal to 1. So if I represent it in terms of that diagram, let's see, we've got four of them, right? So this is site I plus 1, I plus 2, I plus 3. So this is a and b. Let's say eta a, eta b, a, b. What this means is that this two Majorana fermions form a state with the product equal to 1. This two form a state, and this two form a state, and so on. Yes?
You kind of just answered it, but can you just explain what you mean when you circle two sides?
Yeah. When I circle two sides, so the two sides contain a two Majorana fermions. Let's call them eta 1, eta 2, there. So by circling them, I'm saying I put it in a state where I eta 1 eta 2 is 1. Remember, I eta 1 eta 2 is a Hermitian operator that squares to 1. So the eigenvalue is plus minus 1. So there are two states spanned by eta 1 and eta 2. So the special feature with this is now you see that can now consider an open boundary condition. Let's say your I runs from, let's say, 1 to n, for example. Yes?
So then does that mean that different circles are independent of each other? They don't know about? Wait,
basically.
They don't know about each other? OK.
Yeah. Because when I say this, because I, B, I plus 1, A, and I prime B, either I prime plus 1, A, is 0 if I not equal to I prime.
Yeah.
So this they all commute, so they can be diagonalized independently. Yeah, so this is the simplest kind of Hamiltonian you can ever imagine. It's a sum of a bunch of commuting operators that all square to 1. So to get the ground state, just set all the operators to be 1. So if I imagine an open boundary condition, then I have a funny situation. This guy and this guy doesn't even appear in my Hamiltonian. They're just decoupled from everything else. So this eta I equal to 1, A, and this eta I equal to n, B, are decoupled from other modes. What does it mean? Well, if the Hamiltonian doesn't even contain them, if you think in terms of the Hamiltonian in terms of a, diagonizing some matrices, then you can think of them as the eigenmodes or the eigenvectors of the BDG Hamiltonian with eigenvalue 0 or with energy 0. they don't appear in the Hamiltonian, which means the matrix element corresponding to them is zero. And these modes are called Majorana zero modes. Let me just call it MZM.
When you say that they don't appear in the Hamiltonian, you mean that in this limit?
In this limit, yeah.
For the ground state, they...
In this limit, the Hamiltonian doesn't even contain... If you look at that term with open boundary condition, the Hamiltonian doesn't even contain them.
Yeah, because you've got eta...
So eta, for example, eta 1a doesn't appear in that t term at all.
But that's just the contingent of our open boundary condition.
Oh yeah.
It's not topological effect.
Sorry?
Is it topological effect at
all? I'll comment on that.
Okay.
But yes. There is a way to see the topological feature of this even on a periodic boundary condition, but slightly more formal. So this way is more illuminating. Yes.
Sorry, I'm just so confused about the pictures.
Yes.
So we have two Majorana fermions, right?
Yes.
Okay, but and if we see things in the CEC dagger basis,
yes.
There's only one particle.
Yes, yes. And that's what I'm going to say next, which is a Majorana fermion shouldn't be counted as a particle. Let me first say what I'm going to do next. So there are two questions you should be asking immediately once you see this. Not necessarily in this order, but let me answer in this order. The first question is, what does it mean? What do this Majorana zero mode mean? What are the consequences? And the second question is how stable, how robust are they? Right? Because I've taken a pretty simple limit. I've taken delta equal to t, I've taken mu equal to zero, and I get this feature. If I just stop there, you shouldn't trust me. It looks extremely fine-tuned. But of course, the reason I'm talking about it is precisely because it's not fine-tuned. And I'll show you why that's the case. Do we still need a break? Whatever, let's do a 5-minute break. All right, let's resume. So what do this Majorana zero modes mean? So let's recall that for an ordinary fermion, which means it's complex, so it's not its own Hermitian conjugate, C defined by this algebra, one, and it implicitly it's also defined as being anti-commuting with every other fermion in the world. So c squared equal to c dagger squared equal to zero. This spans a Hilbert space dimension of dimension two. Let's call the Hilbert space H of dimension two. Which is the vacuum, and the vacuum acted with the C dagger. But C comes with two Majoranas, eta A plus I eta B over two. The mod two, the over two is just a normalization, so it doesn't really matter. So what does it mean? It means that it takes two Majoranas. To span a Hilbert space with dimension two. A Hilbert space of dimension two is the minimum Hilbert space you can ever have, beside the trivial one. So now if you ask, what is the Hilbert space dimension spanned by a single Majorana? You don't get a sensible answer. Right? This actually tells you that a single Majorana operator, eta, does not span a Hilbert space. If you like, formally, people say this quite often. If you think about, if you have M, let's say if I have one operator that spans a Hilbert space dimension D, and if I have two of them, what is the Hilbert space dimension I span? It's D squared, because it's a tensor product. Okay. Which means if I really want to say eta, a single eta spans a Hilbert space, that Hilbert space spanned by this eta has dimension square root 2. Yep. Which really means it doesn't span a Hilbert space.
But the eta, doesn't eta span like a real Hilbert space?
No, it doesn't. Yeah. Yeah. So, take a little bit of time to digest that statement. Which means that if I start from a well-defined Hilbert space, so in a well-defined Hilbert space H, this eta always appear in pairs. Right. It will be funny if I start from a Hilbert space, let's say, of dimension 8, and then I add some Hamiltonian, and I solve it, and then I conclude my Hilbert space has dimension, 4 times square root 2. That probably means I've done something terribly wrong. And that's consistent here. Here you have left and right, so you have two Majorana zero modes here.
So what's the mind? I don't understand.
Yeah, the real lesson is you shouldn't treat eta as seriously a particle.
Okay.
It's not. If the thing is not necessarily all operator gives you a reasonable particle. Right? CC dagger does. It spans, you can define a reasonable Hilbert space. Eta's don't.
But this seems to be like related to the essential fact that eta, then you might ask, well, is eta the creation or the annihilation of your operator, because eta equals eta dagger?
Yes. Yes.
That, right?
Yes. Okay. I mean, if you like field theory, actually, that's saying that this eta is like a 0 plus 1d, because it's a point. It's a 0 plus 1d Majorana fermion. It turns out a single flavor of 0 plus 1d Majorana fermion has a gravitational anomaly. But anyway, if you can neglect that statement. Why did I even bother? Anyway, so now let's look at the actual example we have. So in actual example we have, let's call this eta left as gamma I equal to 1 a, and eta right as eta as eta I equal to n b. Right, so that's the two Majorana zero modes we have for this system. So now we define complex fermion. So we have a pair of them, so we can now define a complex fermion. C tilde defined as eta left plus I eta right mod 2. So C tilde dagger will be the dagger of this. So this will be very different from my microscopic CIs, because this is, if you like, a superposition of two Majorana fermions living infinitely far away. But if I look at the algebra, this C tilde is just an ordinary complex fermion, right? It obeys all the nice algebra. This is 0, C tilde C tilde dagger is one. So it's as complex fermion as you know any other complex fermion. In particular, it spans a Hilbert space of dimension 2. So now the Hilbert space contains formally a state that's annihilated by this C tilde. So let me call it eta, the omega defined as a state that annihilates it. And then on top of that, the C tilde dagger eta. The omega. And because the Hamiltonian doesn't involve eta left and eta right, it can't involve CC dagger, C tilde dagger as well. So these two states should have the same energy. So this is they're both the ground state of my system. This gives me a twofold degenerate ground state. So this is already non-trivial because in the atomic limit, the ground state is unique, even on an open boundary condition, because it's literally just C dagger I, CI equal to one on every site. There's no degeneracy. But for this case, if I'm on a closed boundary, then there's no ground state degeneracy as well. But the minute I have an open boundary condition, the ground state degeneracy is two, not one. Yes.
So to define that state omega, we also redefine C tildes. So now we mix eta I B with eta I plus one A to define a new C. So omega is going to be annihilated not only by C tilde dagger, but for the new C's that I built from the B from one side and the A from the next one.
Let me show you what omega actually looks like. It's not that bad. The thing is, the ground state is defined as having this kind of Majorana pairs to have eigenvalue 1, right? So, but if you look at how many conditions that gives you, it's n minus 1, right? You look at the atomic insulator site, on every site you have the condition I eta A eta B equal to 1. So if I have n site, you have n such condition. That fixes the ground state uniquely. But here, you only have n minus 1 of them. You're missing one condition. That's where you get that extra two dimension. Yeah. But let's get a better idea of what's the real difference between these two ground states. Okay. So one thing that's clear is that these two states differ by the fermion occupation number of C dagger C. But alternatively, you can say that they're labeled by the fermion parity defined by the associated with the C tilde, okay, which is I gamma left, gamma right. This can be either plus or minus 1. But now if I ask the question of what is the total fermion parity of the system, essentially, the total number of fermions mod 2, or minus 1 to that. Okay. So that's, sometimes it's called minus 1 to the f. So the definition is that it's the product on every site of the fermion parity, which is also the product on every site of minus I gamma I A gamma I B. Now it's a bunch of product. You can reorganize it. Essentially, this also happened to be equal to minus I gamma 1a gamma n b and then multiply by all this minus I gamma I b gamma I plus 1a. It's just a reorganize. It's a string of Majorana operator. Sorry, I'm using gamma now.
Yes.
Yeah. Is it okay if I use gamma? Gamma means eta. I'll be using gamma. Those gamma k's won't come back in the for today, so it shouldn't be confusing. Right. So it's a string of gamma operators. You can reorganize how you take the product. But this we know is supposed to be, well, when I take t to be negative, they are minus ones. Yes. So then you get minus 1 to the n minus 1. So it's some number. It's some sign. Some constant sign. That's the thing. Times this I gamma 1a gamma n b, which is this operator. Which means that the two ground states differ in total fermion parity. Yeah, so basically they have different fermion number, mod 1. Mod 2. Yes?
In the line with two states labeled, we have tildes and left and right spinners. And then the next line, we have normal things.
Yes. So these are the CICR dagger in the real space Hamiltonian.
Okay.
Right. So this is the product of the fermion parity, I mean minus one to the fermion occupation number on every site. Right. If you like, I mean this formula is equal to minus one to the sum of CI dagger CI. So it's essentially the total number of fermions mod 2.
So why did we introduce the left and the right?
Sorry?
So why did we define the left and the right?
The left and right means the two zero modes.
Okay.
Right. So eta, you can define, on every side there's a eta I A, eta I B. Right. But the thing is, for that specific Hamiltonian, these two etas have zero energy. So they are special. You can think of all the other etas beside this beside the left and right one. They're all dead. They're all locked with some nearby eta to form a specific state. The two zero modes on the two ends are somehow free. Now let me say a little bit more about funny feature of this. So this is a twofold degenerate state. But suppose I want to do some measurement and tell which state out of the two states I'm actually in. If I hand you a wave function, it turns out to be very difficult. Because this quantity cannot be measured locally. For example, if you try to, say, measure things like CI dagger CI, even things like CI plus 1 CI, and so on, you take some local measurement, you don't measure this funny thing. Because essentially, it's an operator that connects, two operators living very far away. So even though it's a two-state Hilbert space, so the other way to say it is that this information of the quantum state or the qubit. Well, it's a two-dimensional Hilbert space, so the fancy name for that is a qubit. Right? That's all there is. So the information of the qubit, which is which means which state it is in the Hilbert space, is shared by gamma L and gamma R. Because only when you combine gamma L and gamma R, the two Majorana zero mode, you get a sensible Hilbert space. A single Majorana fermion doesn't even give you a sensible Hilbert space. Right, so any information in that Hilbert space is also shared by the two. But these two live very far away. So if it's difficult to measure, it means that it's also difficult to perturb. It's also hard. For local perturbation. Local perturbation could be something you add by hand, or it could be something that comes from environment. To change the state. Because to change the state, you need some operator that looks like this. Right? But typical perturbations only connect a fermion to a fermion nearby. Right? It typically has finite range. So that gives you robust information storage. And that's a basis of essentially topological quantum information processing. I mean, it's the simplest example of that. There are much more sophisticated examples.
Doesn't it also mean it's difficult to manipulate?
Yes. You're bang on. Yes. I'll give you an example of manipulating this funny things next time. It's difficult to manipulate, it's difficult to measure, but it stores information pretty well. Okay. So what you can pictorically say that each end stores 1/2 of a qubit. Yeah, that's why if you try to mess up one end, you can't perturb the actual state. Now let me come back to the robustness problem. If it's hard to perturb, then that should also mean that if I move my Hamiltonian away from that extremely simple limit, this feature should be robust. Okay. So one way to argue is to say if I have a very long chain, as I showed you, if I take a half chain, I get a Hilbert space of dimension square root 2, which means I can't really take the half chain. But suppose I, take this seriously. So I add a perturbation, or in a more familiar term, I evolve the system adiabatically. Let's say I gradually turn on some additional term, for example, turn on some extra delta. So now delta is no longer equal to T, or I can turn on some chemical potential, so it's not exactly zero. I can even turn on interaction. Right? So that BDG Hamiltonian is non-interacting, it's quadratic in C. But I'm free to turn on some C dagger CC, or even CCCC from different sides, of course. But as long as the evolution is adiabatic, meaning that as long as gap does not close. In the free fermion model, it means that mu is kept to be smaller than 2t. Okay. So this feature should survive, meaning I should still have this one. Because you can argue for the inverse. If somehow by doing an adiabatic evolution, I get an integer Hilbert space dimension. Then I can do the reverse adiabatic evolution. Then I'm getting out of the integer Hilbert space, integer dimension Hilbert space, which should be well defined, a single Majorana fermion with a Hilbert space dimension square root 2. That sounds like nonsense. So which means this Majorana zero mode is stable as long as the evolution is adiabatic. So under adiabatic evolution. Well, it doesn't mean that literally nothing changes. It changes a little bit. What will change is that the Majorana zero mode, let me call it, for example, let's look at the right end, the gamma r. Before, it's just the gamma n b. But now it doesn't have to be, in fact. It can be, you know, gamma n b up to some normalization, a summation of a bunch of things. A or b. Essentially, if you view this coefficient as a wave function, the wave function doesn't have to be exactly sitting at the right end. It can leak a little bit into the bulk, but it should decay exponentially. Remember your homework. This is exactly what happens on the edge of the integer quantum Hoyt state. So what you will find if I move away from the ideal limit is that there still exists some zero energy Majorana modes with EO-defined Hilbert space dimension. But then the wave function of that mode decays exponentially into the bulk. Okay. So this C, okay, it's different from the coherence length, but we call it the correlation function, correlation length. Also, before, the two states spanned by this two Majorana fermions are exactly degenerate. Now they don't have to be exactly degenerate, because this exponential decay inside the bulk, the two modes can touch a little bit. So the local interaction or local coupling can induce a coupling between the two Majorana modes that looks like I gamma L gamma R, but with an amplitude that's exponentially small. Essentially because the wave function we expect to decay exponentially. So as long as my chain is not too short, this is pretty negligible. So the two ground state will not be exactly degenerate. They differ by energy of order e to the minus n over c.
So how to calculate C is a function of what?
Cause in general is a function of everything. It's a function of delta mu interaction, right? Yeah, I'm not sure. Okay, I guess in this case, even if you move, yeah. The thing is this delta equal to delta equal to t, mu equal to zero magic limit gives you c equal to zero. So everything is exactly localized at the very edge. But in general, you expect C to be some function of, let's say, delta minus T and mu. And in fact, we know that as mu approaches 2T, which is your system is getting gapless, what happens is this C will diverge. And then you can no longer use this argument. The two Majorana modes will mix. And when mu becomes larger than 2t, the two Majorana modes disappear.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Can you just explain again like what you wrote here? Because here we have a phi, and then we have a psi, and then we have like an...
Phi. Yes. So
okay, but is y is a function of?
It's a function of the position, right? So
okay.
Yeah, maybe I should write the left. That's clear. So originally it's gamma 1a, right? So now in principle it could be gamma 1a superposed with a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's gamma, you know, x, a, or b. Right. The thing is this, so the coefficient of this superposition we interpret as some kind of wave function. Right. And the important thing is that wave function decays exponentially as I move to the bulk. So I can still legitimately think of it as just living on the boundary. Yeah, so this is really just very similar to the edge mode wave function of the integer quantum bulk. Yeah, so this fact you can, you know, as you tune away from this magic limit, you get some non-zero C. You can show explicitly, but I'm not going to show you here today. So that's it for today. So next time we do a 2D version of this. It's actually a superconducting analog of the chain insulator or integer quantum Hall effect. The funny thing about there is that it's a preview. The Abrikosov vortex in that superconductor also traps this Majorana zero mode. And because it's a vortex, we can actually do some manipulation. There you are able to manipulate this non-local qubit by braiding or exchanging these vortices. And it turns out that gives you non-abelian anion statistics. So we'll see some of that next time.